This episode of New Politics was released on the 25th of June, 2022, and produced on the land of the Wangal and Whadjuk people.
Welcome to New Politics. In this episode, the Greens have their best election result ever, but will they be able to work with the Labor Party? The Liberal Party fighting the last election all over again? And it's never ending, but there's more corruption in New South Wales. This time it's jobs for the boys. I'm Eddie Djokovic, editor of New Politics.
I'm David Lewis, suave urban sophisticate.
A big thank you to our new Patreon subscribers. Thanks for signing up. And if you'd like to support New Politics, you can support us through a Patreon subscription. It's just $5 per month for the Ruby Standard supporter level or $10 per month for the Gold Standard supporter level. But whether it's a subscription or if you just want to listen in, read our material online or buy a t-shirt or buy a book, it's all available at newpolitics.com.au. And all of this is a good way to support independent journalism. The Australian Greens have just had their best election result ever. They now have four lower house MPs and 12 senators and 12.25% of the primary vote all across Australia. They did start off with Bob Brown as their first senator in 1996, although the WA Greens did have three senators before that between 1990 and 1998. And the Greens have now exceeded their previous high watermark of 10 senators in 2013. In the lower house, they sit on the crossbench, so they'll have four seats out of the total number of 16 on the crossbench. But Labor already holds the lower house in its own right, with 77 of the 151 seats. In the Senate, it's a different story there, and this is where the Greens will have their critical influence. Labor does hold 26 Senate seats, and with the Greens 12 Senate seats and one other senator, more than likely the independent Senator David Pocock, they'll be able to pass legislation. And of course, they could always try and get support from coalition senators, but the easier pathway seems to be getting the Greens on side. But what sort of price will the Greens command to support and pass Labor legislation? And what type of issues will Labor have to give up to support the demands of the Greens?
The Greens are a separate party to Labor. I think that's the first thing we've got to remember in any of these conversations. They probably are a little bit more progressive, if you were to graph it all out, than Labor. They may be a little bit more economically conservative, again, if you were to graph it all out. And like the other parties, the Greens have these underlying fundamental cracks that need to be managed. This isn't a criticism of the Greens. All parties have this. In times of success, you tend to see them less. Or sometimes it brings it out more as people are emboldened by electoral success. In times of doldrums, it tends to come out. Now, we're in a strange time in that the Liberal Party cracks were very obvious at a time of their success, although in retrospect, turns out that it was a dying party heading to an election in which it was going to get severely thumped. And some of those issues were starting to come out. And I'm talking about things like the New South Wales Liberal Party being disbanded so that the federal body could impose its wishes on who got seats, etc. Now, I'm not here to bash the Liberals at this point. Let's get back to the Greens. The Greens do have some tensions. Now, I've said before, they're probably the broadest church in Australia, covering every political point from your very wealthy Toorak NIMBY to your almost broke Byron Bay hippie. And every single point in between that creates challenges. And we've seen that the party convener in Victoria was appointed and then had to stand down and the process start again. She had said some comments that weren't as inclusive as other members would have liked, and she was urged not to run again. So there are those tensions in the Greens, but they're also feeling emboldened. Adam Bandt, who performed extremely well during the election campaign, I thought. It kept journalists in place. He had a clear message. And of course, he's clearly a pretty decent local member. To hold a fairly safe Labor seat for a few elections is no mean feat. Adam Bandt has suggested that he's going to be hardline in terms of what he expects the government to do. Now, the Labor Party has promised a 43% reduction in emissions. Now, I agree that this probably isn't enough, but what worries me, and I'm not here to say that the Greens should just fall into line behind Labor and do exactly as Labor says, it's never how it works, and it's not how it should work either. But what worries me is that the last time the Greens went very hardline and refused to compromise, we ended up with Tony Abbott as Prime Minister. It wasn't the only factor, and the Greens weren't the only thing to blame there, but it was a part of it. And I do think that the Greens are an important part of the polity and need a voice.
Well, in the public domain, both the Labor Party MPs and Green MPs will dismiss each other's credentials and their agendas. Last week, we highlighted Paul Erickson at the National Press Club, and here's what he said about Adam Bandt, the leader of the Australian Greens.
On the Greens, there's no doubt that the Greens are an effective campaign machine. And they do have a very successful strategy that they've honed over 20 years, which is to always position yourself two steps to the left of Labor, minimise our successes, give zero credit for any of the progressive gains that Labor governments make, constantly criticise and seek to divide Labor's base in a manner that doesn't help progressive politics. That's what Adam's entire adult life has been about.
Paul Erickson is not a Labor MP, but he is a senior figure within the Labor Party. He's the National Secretary, and the hardline elements within both parties will say some pretty horrible things about people in the other party. But as you mentioned before, David, we do have to remember that the Labor Party and the Australian Greens are totally different parties. They're different entities, different structures, they've got different people, and they're both out to maximise their primary vote and get that $3 per vote from the Australian Electoral Commission. And on that level, they don't really care where they're getting the vote from. And if they have to attack each other to do that, well, that's what they'll actually do. Generally, around 80% of preferences from the Greens flow on to the Labor Party. And there were some partisan players at the last election saying that a vote for the Greens would be a vote for the coalition in the sense that it would help the coalition win seats. Now, there's absolutely no evidence to support this, but again, it gets down to both parties being totally different parties and each of them trying to get the best outcomes for them. And that's totally understandable politically and administratively. But the Greens and the Labor Party, they do need to be more cooperative with each other. They haven't got exactly the same agenda, but they do have similar agendas. And my feeling is that they should start working towards some common goals, especially after the past 9 years of political paralysis under the Liberal National Coalition.
I could imagine that the Greens are very excited to actually have something of a say, particularly in the Senate. They have to be aware that Labor has almost as broad a church as they do. And there's people in the Labor Party who support some of the industries that the Greens don't support. I'm not saying one side is right or one side is wrong. And on these issues, I'm probably inclined to be closer to the Green side than the broader Labor side without seeing anybody wanting to lose their jobs. The CFMEU is a big part of the makeup of Labor. And that's construction, mining, forestry, electricity. And those are industries, probably all of them actually, that the Greens would like to see fundamentally change. And of course, their members don't want to see much change because of the worry of jobs. There are interests to be balanced here. And I don't want to say that all people in mining are complete anti-environmental nutcases or anything like that. I know that's not true. A lot of people are very worried, the people who work in mining, who are worried about the future and who want to see a change in the industry, but they want to see a change that's a sustainable change that keeps their jobs. This is all fair enough too. And it's very easy to sort of sit thousands of miles away and make pronouncements on what is exactly right and exactly wrong. The other issue too that I haven't touched on, native title and mining, and we need to acknowledge that. And that's a part of the debate that hasn't come through yet. I'm sure it will. It hasn't quite hit the major players in the debate.
And we also have to remember that the CFMEU, they've actually donated to the Australian Greens in the past. Traditionally, unions do donate to the Labor Party, but previously we have talked about the possibility of a Labor-Greens coalition in government, and we previously ruled that out purely on mathematics, that the Labor Party doesn't need the Greens to form government, and until that time that it does, it will continue to get those preferences flowing back from the Greens and sit there and enjoy it, and the Greens won't get very much in return. But I think that this recent election result does start to change things a little bit. So the Greens now have those four seats in the lower house, and that's a long way off from the 76 seats that they need to form government. But they're starting to take more seats from the Labor Party. And of those four seats that they currently have, two were previously held by the Labor Party. And this is some way into the future. But if the Greens start picking up 2 to 3 seats at each election over the next decade, and if those seats are picked up off the Labor Party, that ends up possibly being a situation where the Labor Party does need to form government in a coalition agreement or an alliance with the Australian Greens. And I don't think that's such a bad thing. Centre-right politics has had a formal coalition in place between the Liberal Party and the National Party, or whatever their predecessors were. They've had that since 1923. And the National Party held 10 seats in the last coalition government. And I know that it gets a little bit mixed up with the LNP as the single entity in Queensland. But if the Greens start getting to 10 seats and beyond over the next few elections, as well as increasing their Senate levels, I think it creates quite a few exciting opportunities for centre-left politics over the next decade or so.
We're seeing a seismic shift, and it's almost unnoticeable because our press are either refusing it or don't see it. But the neoliberal model, which failed almost as soon as it started, is being discarded, and this is all over the world, whether it's the Jungian collective consciousness working or whether it's just enough people have finally realized that it doesn't work. And I think, too, one of the things that the last election showed was a move away from parties. The Liberal Party were very quick to point out Labor's historically low primary vote. It wasn't just that people stopped voting for Labor. There was a lot of strategic voting in that, people putting minor parties first, knowing that Labor would win on preferences, some protests against both major parties, particularly from the right, interestingly enough. And I think some of that masks the fact that we seem to be moving away from a party system. And we're definitely moving away from a neoliberal, free market, privatized system. The candidates that did the best tended to not be that. And that includes the Teal independence. We're looking at this paradigm shift, and that's a factor, I think, in explaining what has gone on.
So back to the current situation, because we are dealing with the here and the now. Labor will need the support of the Greens to pass legislation in the Senate and another senator on top of that, and that will get them to the magic number of 39 out of the 76 senators to pass legislation. And the assumption is that that other senator will be David Pocock, but we don't know very much about David Pocock. I know that he was a famous rugby player and he ran on a progressive agenda in the ACT, but that's about it. We don't really know what his demands will be to pass legislation in the Senate. But aside from that, I guess the main game will be with the Labor Party and the Greens in the Senate. And it will be interesting to see what sort of policy tension there will be and what sort of negotiations take place, as well as those final outcomes. But Adam Bandt has already started complaining that Labor has got a take-it-or-leave-it approach to climate change, and that's not good enough. And the Greens do want to go much harder on climate change issues, and why not? They're a party of the environment, so that makes a lot of sense. But there's a wide range of other issues that they can claim a mandate from the electorate to push forward their agendas. And that could include a lot of issues that have got a lot of crossover with the Labor Party: universal healthcare, universal childcare, basic income support, housing. The Greens have also called for free higher education, but Labor's probably not going to back that idea, considering they're the ones who actually introduced the HECS system back in 1990. But also the other factor is that the Greens are not the activist fringe party anymore, although they do sometimes behave like one. They've got four MPs, 12 senators, 12.25% of the primary vote. It's not exactly mainstream, but as a comparison, Labor has 32% of the primary vote, at the last election. The Liberal Party has 24% of the primary vote. The National Party only has around 4 to 5% of the primary vote. So it's a level of voter support in the electorate that cannot be ignored for much longer.
They've done an extremely good job. And for all the criticisms I've made, I want to acknowledge that they did incredibly well in the last election. And if they play their cards right, they've got themselves a basis for another few decades at least in Parliament. And breaking that model that I'd pointed out before, that minor parties tend to last about 20 years. They may have given themselves an extra at least 20 years. That's a remarkable achievement, particularly in a fairly hostile environment. The press doesn't like them. I'm pretty sure that there are Labour people who hate the Greens more than they hate the other Labour factions and the Liberal Party, and that's a deep level of hate. I think they've got to start thinking about what being a party of maturity is. They've got some really good candidates, by the way. And I've pointed out before, I wasn't the first one to point this out, that the Nationals get a whole lot more seats than the Greens do, despite having far less primary vote. It's something that the Greens could become a very strong and important voice for progressivism and progressive policies. I do think that there may be a coalition on the cards if they keep, not next election even, it'd be maybe the election after, or maybe the one after that, which is only 9 years away or 12 years away, which is nothing in the lifetime of a parliament, really. It's a long time when you look at it, but when you look back on it, it's not that long.
Oh, you're absolutely right. 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 years, that's not very long at all, but just looking a little bit back in history, and we do like to look at history on New Politics. In 2009, the Australian Greens didn't support the carbon pollution reduction scheme that was going to be introduced by the Rudd government. And I don't think that it was the best scheme available, but it wasn't too bad. But the Greens wanted higher emissions. And in hindsight, I do think that the Labor Party at that time, they probably seemed to be more interested in using the legislation to create a trigger for a double dissolution election and also use it to beat Malcolm Turnbull up, who was the opposition leader of the Liberal Party at the time. And I don't necessarily want to get into a debate about who was responsible for the CPRS not being implemented, because we'll be still debating that for a couple of weeks and we've got sleep to catch up on, David. But the Greens did support the carbon pricing mechanism during the time of the Gillard government, and I don't think that was as effective as CPRS. And again, I don't want to get into a debate about that, because we'll be here for another 2 weeks on top of the 2 weeks discussing who was responsible for the CPRS not being implemented. But carbon pricing mechanism, that actually caused a large political problem. The issue ended up having nothing to do with the environment and everything to do with Tony Abbott wanting to get back into government. Axe the tax became a clarion call for the Liberal Party at the time, even though it wasn't actually a tax. They won the 2013 election, and carbon pricing mechanism was removed in 2014, which meant that for 9 years, which was probably the time that it was needed most, there was no carbon pollution reduction scheme or pricing mechanism. Now, before we get all of those Green supporters ringing us up or shaking their fists at us and accusing us of accusing the Greens of causing mischief, I'm not actually saying that. I'm just suggesting that the wiser people in the Greens are probably thinking, well, maybe we should have supported the CPRS in 2009 as a building block for future mechanisms, because in politics, you can't always get what you want. And in fact, you rarely get what you want. Politics is the art of compromise and working out ways to achieve your agenda, because you're not going to get everything that you want in the one go. Now, everyone has to learn from history, but do you think that the Greens and the Labor Party, of course, will be able to learn from the experiences of 2009 and 2010 when they all start negotiating their legislative deals in this new parliament?
I'd hope so. The other thing too is that we're still early in a new parliament, and so major mistakes may be corrected and learned from. The other thing too that may embolden the Greens is that the Liberal Party are nowhere near being able to take office, even if the Greens were to side with them, even if Peter Dutton was to come up with a plan that the Greens felt was better than the Labor plan. There's still not the numbers there to take government or force an election or even block legislation. So there is room for error till we start looking at the awful effects of climate change. We lost 9 years, and there are wiser heads in the Greens. There's people who've been there since the very beginning and have seen the Greens in ascendancy and have seen them in decline, who I would assume want to see the Greens back in the ascendancy and can work out a way of being able to maintain their feeling of self-worth, to live with the decisions they make. And these are important things for some politicians anyway. And I get all that too. And I also get the urgency of being able to fix things before it's too late, if it's not already too late. There's a lot of hard decisions that are going to have to be made by a lot of people. But you've got to look at sometimes not just the big picture, but the less big picture as well. And of course, this goes for Labor too. Some of those factions that are going to fight any change to environmental policy may need to sit down and think, well, in fact, it's more than just our employment future, it's our actual future at stake. I believe that a compromise that makes everybody happy is possible, and that it's building blocks. And yes, we don't have the luxury to do a 50-year plan, but we might have the luxury to do a 6-year plan or a 10-year plan that gets us to where we need to be in that time.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or find us at newpolitics.com.au, and you can now support New Politics through Patreon.
And of course, the 2022 election is far behind us now, but the new opposition leader, Peter Dutton, is already fighting the last election all over again. He did say that if he became the leader of the Liberal Party, he was prepared to show a softer side of his personality, but I've got a feeling that the soft side and the hard side of Peter Dutton are actually the same thing. There just doesn't seem to be that much difference there. Already, he's playing the blame game, attacking Labor at every opportunity, saying that he doesn't see the need to change any of the Liberal Party climate policies and targets, even though the Liberal National Coalition was comprehensively defeated at this recent election, and their lack of action on climate change was a strong reason for this defeat. The position of opposition leader just after a government has been defeated is the most difficult job in politics, and their job is mainly to stabilise the party and prepare for its return to office at some point in the future. But that's likely to take some time. There hasn't been a one-term government since the Scullin government lost the 1932 election, so it's probably better for Peter Dutton to try and modernise the party and spend the next 6 years trying to become a better political party instead of trying to fight the 2022 federal election all over again.
I wonder if Peter Dutton was the right person. And I'm not sure that the next Liberal Prime Minister is actually in the House of Reps yet. Dutton is, I think, the last remnant of that hardline, far-right, neoliberal agenda that we've been forced on over the last 40 years. He's, in a sense, the death rattle of that. There's doubt whether he'll make the next election. It sounds weird saying this, but there's no other obvious candidate. There's talk that Josh Frydenberg will be given the seat of Cook if he wins that. This is a guy who lost the seat of Kooyong, so I'm not sure that he's really going to be given another plum seat for a long time, particularly as the Liberal Party don't want to push the Labor majority to 3 seats, because at the moment there's still the rough chance that you have a scandal and a health crisis, and of course we hope that neither of those happen. But the government could be pushed into some kind of minority where even a small numerical party can start to be a nuisance. with a third seat, that becomes harder again. So all this talk about Josh Frydenberg getting the seat of Cook and then winning the seat of Cook. And of course, Frydenberg's been putting it in the press that he's open to taking the job of the AFL CEO.
Well, that's the end of the AFL then.
Pretty much. Apparently it was a plant from him to try and get them to consider him. Now, I have to be very honest. I don't know enough. I don't even know if the job is being advertised. I don't know who was in the job. I don't know anything about the job, except I know that AFL exists as a sport and I've been to a couple of games.
Well, maybe that's all we need to know. But just for a bit of context, Anthony Albanese is the first new opposition leader immediately after an election loss. And that's what happened for the Labor Party at the 2019 election, to then go on and win their first election and then become Prime Minister. So the precedent has been set, and it's always possible for Peter Dutton to go on and repeat this success, but it does seem unlikely. We do have to remember, though, that in mid-2020, that was about 6 months into the pandemic, so many political experts and political journalists were suggesting that Labor should give up trying to win the 2022 election and start preparing for the 2025 election, probably under Jim Chalmers or Tanya Plibersek as the leader. And looking back, you can see the reasoning for this. Scott Morrison, at the time, he did have an approval rating of 68%. 61% of people preferred Scott Morrison as Prime Minister, as opposed to 22% for Albanese. The coalition consistently had 54% of the two-party preferred vote in opinion polls. But look at it now. Less than 2 years later, Albanese is the Prime Minister. Scott Morrison is in the dustbin. And now all the talk is about how many elections will it take for the Liberal Party to be electable again. So events in politics can change quite quickly.
I think it was Earl Page, one of the National or Country Party then grandees, who basically said, in politics, you're cock of the walk one day and feather duster the next. Harold Macmillan, British Prime Minister, what is being Prime Minister about? Events, dear boy, events. Anything can happen. A scandal can erupt from nowhere. A global conflict can erupt from nowhere. A government that is travelling along, and we've seen this so many times, is suddenly on the nose because of something that they had no idea about. When we look at sudden resignations, the Tasmanian Prime Minister, the Northern Territory Chief Minister, we always wonder, Bob Carr, what happened? Mike Baird, we always wonder, what happened? They say, I want to spend more time with my family. I'm tired. I just can't do the job anymore. These are all valid reasons, if they're 100% of the reason. But there's always a bit of us that says, is that all there is to it? And this could happen too. And then, yeah, we're looking down the barrel of Peter Dutton as Prime Minister. Now, a lot of the support he has in the party, let's be fair, is because a lot of moderates lost their seats, not pretend moderates like Tim Wilson and Josh Frydenberg, but actual moderates, so that Dutton's faction is numerically strong in its numerically weak position in the House. Political maths, it's wonderful.
Well, I did refer to this before, that just after an election loss, the job of the opposition leader is to stabilise the party. Andrew Peacock did this in 1984 for the Liberal Party. Kim Beazley almost wins the 1998 election after a massive Labor loss in 1996. Bill Shorten does almost the same in 2016 after a massive Labor loss in 2013. I guess my question is, can Peter Dutton stabilise the Liberal Party? Brendan Nelson wasn't able to do this for the Liberal Party after their loss at the 2007 election, nor could Malcolm Turnbull when he got rid of Brendan Nelson and became the leader of the opposition at that time. Sometimes it's better just to forget about trying to win the next election. And I realise that this is hard for a party to say, well, okay, that's all fine. We're not going to try and win the next election. It's just better to try and get better candidates and put better systems in place. But that's exactly what the Labor Party did, although it did take them 9 years to return to office. But already, Peter Dutton is trying to pin the blame for the energy crisis on Labor. Although as more information about this is made public, people are actually shocked to find out how badly the coalition handled energy during their time in office. We keep hearing from journalists that Peter Dutton is well-liked within the party, but even if that is true, being well-liked within your own party doesn't translate into electoral success. But I do think that the big problem is that he's trying to win the next election based on the issues from the previous election, and saying that he's not going to change the Liberal Party position on climate change is a big mistake, as well as trying to continue the climate wars and the culture wars as well.
They have this feeling that the culture wars are very successful, that if we can jump on the everybody's woke and politically correct and look what we're not allowed to do. And they've been trying this for 10 years, and I'll be fair, to varying levels of success. But they keep trying it, and it's less and less effective. There are people who are petrified of a return to a Liberal government because they're worried that they'll be thrown into jail for expressing themselves in the way that they are. It's been a change that I think Peter Dutton either hasn't noticed, and Peter Dutton's followers haven't noticed or refuse to notice. So Peter Dutton trying what's called otherism, trying to kick into minorities, just isn't working. Very few people criticise the Mungarapan family going back to Bilawala, which I suspect in 1996 and in 2013 might have been different. Now, whether these people have been oppressed from their being able to have a free opinion and being able to express that opinion, or whether community standards have changed, is an interesting debate. And I suspect community standards have changed for the most part.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or find us at newpolitics.com.au, and you can now support New Politics through Patreon.
Our good friend John Barilaro is in a little bit of trouble again, and for those of you outside of New South Wales, he was the leader of the Nationals Party within the New South Wales Parliament, which means that he was also the Deputy Premier. And while he was the Deputy Premier in November 2020, he created six Trade Commissioner roles based in the United States, Britain, Japan, China, India and Singapore. So far, so good. Now, I don't think any of these positions actually have that much value. And they will cost the New South Wales government $112 million to create these positions. But if that's what the government wants to do, well, good luck to them. The position for the United States, it was actually offered to a highly credentialed candidate in August 2021. Again, so far, so good. But then John Barilaro resigned from politics in October 2021. The offer to the successful, highly credentialed candidate was rescinded, and she was actually paid compensation as well. And lo and behold, John Barilaro is offered the position at a salary of $500,000 per year in June 2022. Now, I know that we do things differently in the Republic of New South Wales, but if this isn't corruption, I really don't know what is.
John Barilaro was the Deputy Premier who threatened to break the coalition over and stormed into Gladys Berejiklian's office and said, if the koala legislation happens, we will leave the coalition. Okay, that's fine. Have a stand on principle, a dumb, stupid, destructive principle, but a principle. He then also suggested that they wouldn't leave their seats in cabinet. Gladys stormed back to his office and basically told him that if you're in coalition, you get ministerial seats. If you're not in coalition, you go under the crossbenches. This is a man who doesn't understand governance. Now, the other issue is, are these jobs necessary? The idea of New South Wales Trade Commissioner or Victorian or Queensland or Western Australian or South Australian or Tasmanian is pre-federation, back when each state had to organise its own importing and exporting and business overseas. Back then, they were probably more necessary. We have Australian envoys. We have Australian ambassadors. Now, of course, there's probably some kind of argument for once you've done the, yes, we're going to do this deal with Australia, to have representatives from New South Wales, etc., say why you should set your business up or trade with the people in this state rather than the people in another state. Maybe. But to have one that seems to be operating separately from the diplomatic corps seems to be a bit ridiculous. So I suspect it was a job that Barilaro had his eye on. When you look at the timeline of this stuff, it's all happening with Gladys Berejiklian being summoned to ICAC, Barilaro leaving all of a sudden for family reasons, corruption nothing to do with it till ICAC hit. It was the public servant who worked with Barilaro who made the final decision that he should get the job, which is on the nose. And the Premier, Dominic Perrottet, claimed that he had nothing to do with it and didn't know what was going on, which at a fairly senior job, you'd think that he'd at least have an idea of the process that went on, even if he had nothing to do with the decision-making. So nobody comes out of this looking very well for a job that is questionable whether it's needed. And of course, the other thing is that someone had already been appointed to the job and has had to be compensated to break the contract. So it's not looking good. I think that the last standing Liberal government of the state may be about to be extremely damaged.
Oh, well, all of this really, really stinks. This is actually a story that was broken by Jordan Shanks, also known as Friendly Geordies. That was way before the mainstream media reported on it. And once again, independent media is way ahead of what the mainstream media will report on. The person who was initially offered the job, Jenny West, she was a senior executive with Austrade, general manager of trade and investment. She also held senior positions with Telstra and Westpac. And to offer the position to someone like her with her background and then rescind the offer and give it to a dilettante like John Barilaro, well, it seems like the position is not that important, as you referred to before. And we also have to ask the question, was this offered as some kind of inducement to John Barilaro to leave politics and remove a political problem for an incumbent premier? We did have a Liberal Party premier having to resign over 30 years ago for pretty much doing the same sort of thing. And you'd also have to think, well, how stupid is New South Wales Premier Dominic Perrottet? It's not like someone like John Barilaro would take up such a lucrative position and fly under the radar. There's also a state election in New South Wales just 9 months away, and this issue has got the potential to completely derail the Liberal Party's election campaign and be the final nail in the coffin of a 12-year-old New South Wales government. The Labor Party has blocked the appointment and are seeking a review of the appointment of John Barilaro to this position, and I think that if it's not deemed to be political corruption, at the very least, it shows a high level of political incompetence and the last throes of an increasingly incompetent Liberal Party as well.
Again, it's the death throes of that neoliberal, far-right, religiously-based movement that has dominated Australian politics since probably 1996, really, with Howard with that 7 or 8 year break in the middle. Perrottet is very open about his Catholic faith, selling cemeteries underhandedly to the Catholic Church without anybody really knowing what was going on. Perrottet himself is way out of his depth as premier. I think that's fair to say. He should never have got the job. The moderates, or the so-called moderates, in the New South Wales Liberal Party made a dreadful mistake in supporting him, and I think they thought they could shut him up. But the only way to shut corruption up is to shut it down, and Perrottet has just let it rip, as he did with COVID. He was the main voice in cabinet saying that business must remain open at all costs. We're seeing the costs now. We still have a pandemic that's out of control and a tanking economy because not enough businesses can stay open because they've got too many staff sick. To get back to Barilaro, he did nothing for New South Wales. I doubt he could point to New South Wales on a world map, to be quite honest. It's just wherever he happens to be. I question the validity of a New South Wales job, and maybe Jenny West could have made something of it. She seems like a fairly capable and experienced person who maybe could have made something useful out of the job. I don't know who's been appointed to the others, but I note too that they're all very colonial. Singapore, New York, London. Barilaro will make nothing of this job because he's made nothing of any job he's ever been in.
That's it for this episode of New Politics. Thanks for listening in. If you'd like to support our style of journalism and commentary, please make a donation at our website at newpolitics.com.au. We don't beg, plead, beseech or gaslight you about journalism coming to an end. We just keep it very simple. If you like what we do, please send some support our way. It keeps our commitment to independent journalism ticking along. I'm Eddie Djokovic. Thanks for listening in, and it's goodbye to our listeners.
I'm David Lewis. We'll see you next time.